Perhaps the most profound effect of the women's movement of the 60s, beyond the actual victories on abortion and job equality, was called consciousness raising, often done in women's groups, which met in homes all across the country. This meant the rethinking of roles, the rejection of inferiority, the confidence in self, a bond of sisterhood, a new solidarity of mother and daughter. The Atlanta poet Esta Seton wrote Her Life. This is the picture that keeps forming in my mind. My young mother, barely 17, cooking their kosher dinner on the coal stove that first winter in Vermont. And my father, mute in his feelings, except when he shouted, eating to show his love. 50 years later, her blue eyes would grow cold with the shock of that gray house and the babies one after another and the doctor who said, "If you don't want any more children, move out of the house." For the first time, the sheer biological uniqueness of women was openly discussed. Some theorists, Shulamith Firestone in The Dialectics of Sex, for instance, thought this was more fundamental to their oppression than any particular economic system. It was liberating to talk frankly about what had for so long been secret, hidden, cause for shame and embarrassment: menstruation, masturbation, menopause, abortion, lesbianism. One of the most influential books to appear in the early 70s was a book assembled by 11 women in the Boston Women's Health Book Collective called Our Bodies, Ourselves. It contained an enormous amount of practical information on women's anatomy, on sexuality and sexual relationships, on lesbianism, on nutrition and health, on rape, self-defense, venereal disease, birth control, abortion, pregnancy, childbirth, and menopause. More important even than the information, the charts, the photos, the candid exploration of the previously unmentioned, was the mood of exuberance throughout the book, the enjoyment of the body, the happiness with the newfound understanding, the new sisterhood with young women, middle-aged women, older women. They quoted the English suffragette Christabel Pankhurst. "Remember the dignity of your womanhood. Do not appeal, do not beg, do not grovel. Take courage, join hands, stand beside us, fight with us." The fight began, many women were saying, with the body, which seemed to be the beginning of the exploitation of women, as sex plaything, weak and incompetent, as pregnant woman, helpless, as middle-aged woman, no longer considered beautiful, as older woman, to be ignored, set aside. A biological prison had been created by men and society. As Adrienne Rich said of Women Born, "Women are controlled by lashing us to our bodies." She wrote, "I have a very clear, keen memory of myself the day after I was married. I was sweeping a floor. Probably the floor did not really need to be swept. Probably I simply did not know what else to do with myself. But as I swept that floor, I thought, now I am a woman. This is an age-old action. This is what women have always done. I felt I was bending to some ancient form, too ancient to question. This is what women have always done. As soon as I was visibly and clearly pregnant, I felt, for the first time in my adolescent and adult life, not guilty. The atmosphere of approval in which I was bathed, even by strangers on the street, it seemed, was like an aura I carried with me, in which doubts, fears, misgivings met with absolute denial. This is what women have always done." Rich said women could use the body as a resource rather than a destiny. Patriarchal systems, she said, whether under capitalism or socialism, limited women's bodies to their own needs. She discussed the training of passivity in women. Generations of schoolgirls were raised on Little Women, where Jo is told by her mother, "I am angry nearly every day of my life, Jo, but I have learned not to show it, and I still hope to learn not to feel it, though it may take me another 40 years to do so." Male doctors used instruments to bring out children, replacing the sensitive hands of midwives in the era of anesthetized, technologized childbirth. Rich disagreed with her fellow feminist Firestone, who wanted to change the biological inevitability of childbirth because it is painful and a source of subordination. She wants, under different social conditions, to make childbirth a source of physical and emotional joy. One could not talk of Freud's ignorance of women, Rich said, as his one blind spot, which implied that in other matters his vision was clear. Such ignorance distorts all. There is a dilemma of the body. I know no woman, virgin, mother, lesbian, married, celibate, whether she earns her keep as a housewife, a cocktail waitress, or a scanner of brainwaves, for whom her body is not a fundamental problem. Its clouded meaning, its fertility, its desire, its so-called frigidity, its bloody speech, its silences, its changes and mutilations, its rapes and ripenings. Her reply to this, the repossession of our bodies, a world in which every woman is the presiding genius of her own body, as a basis for bringing forth not just children, but new visions, new meanings, a new world. For most women who were not intellectuals, the question was even more immediate: how to eliminate hunger, suffering, subordination, humiliation in the here and now. A woman named Johnny Tillman wrote in 1972, "I'm a woman. I'm a black woman. I'm a poor woman. I'm a fat woman. I'm a middle-aged woman, and I'm on welfare. I have raised 6 children. I grew up in Arkansas, worked there for 15 years in a laundry, moved to California. In 1963, I got too sick to work anymore. Friends helped me to go on welfare." Welfare is like a traffic accident. It can happen to anybody, but especially it happens to women. And that is why welfare is a women's issue. For a lot of middle-class women in this country, women's liberation is a matter of concern. For women on welfare, it's a matter of survival. Welfare, she said, was like a super sexist marriage. You trade in a man for the man. The man runs everything, controls your money. She and other welfare mothers organized a national welfare rights organization. They urged that women be paid for their work, housekeeping, child rearing. No woman can be liberated until all women get off their knees. In the problem of women was the germ of a solution, not only for their oppression, but for everybody's. The control of women in society was ingeniously effective. It was not done directly by the state. Instead, the family was used: men to control women, women to control children, all to be preoccupied with one another, to turn to one another for help, to blame one another for trouble, to do violence to one another when things weren't going right. Why could this not be turned around? Could women liberating themselves, children freeing themselves, men and women beginning to understand one another, find the source of their common oppression outside rather than in one another? Perhaps then they could create nuggets of strength in their own relationships, millions of pockets of insurrection. They could revolutionize thought and behavior in exactly that seclusion of family privacy which the system had counted on to do its work of control and indoctrination. And together, instead of at odds, male, female, parents, children, they could undertake the changing of society itself. It was a time of uprisings. If there could be a rebellion inside that most subtle and complex of prisons, the family, it was reasonable that there be rebellions in the most brutal and obvious of prisons, the penitentiary system itself. In the 60s and early 70s, those rebellions multiplied. They also took on an unprecedented political character and the ferocity of class war, coming to a climax at Attica, New York, in September of 1971. The prison had arisen in the United States as an attempt at Quaker reform to replace mutilation, hanging, exile, the traditional punishments during colonial times. The prison was intended, through isolation, to produce repentance and salvation, but prisoners went insane and died in that isolation. By mid-19th century, the prison was based on hard labor, along with various punishments: sweat boxes, iron yokes, solitary. The approach was summed up by the warden at the Ossining, New York Penitentiary. In order to reform a criminal, you must first break his spirit. that approach persisted. Prison officials would convene annually to congratulate themselves on the progress being made. The president of the American Correctional Association, delivering the annual address in 1966, described the new edition of the Manual of Correctional Standards. "It permits us to linger, if we will, at the gates of correctional Valhalla, with an abiding pride in the sense of a job superbly done. We may be proud, we may be satisfied, we may be content." He said this just after, in the midst of, and just before the most intense series of prison uprisings the country had ever seen. There had always been prison riots. A wave of them in the 1920s ended with a riot at Clinton, New York, a prison of 1,600 inmates, which was suppressed with three prisoners killed. Between 1950 and 1953, more than 50 major riots occurred in American prisons. In the early 1960s, prisoners on a work gang in Georgia smashing rocks used the same sledgehammers to break their legs to call attention to their situation of daily brutality. At San Quentin Prison in California, which housed 4,000 prisoners, there was a series of revolts in the late 60s. A race riot in 1967, a united black-white general strike in early 1968 that shut down almost all the prison industries, and then a second strike that summer. At the Queens House of Detention on Long Island in New York in the fall of 1970, prisoners took over the jail, took hostages, issued demands. The prisoners' negotiating committee included four blacks, one Puerto Rican, one white. They demanded immediate bail hearings on 47 cases that they said were examples of racism in the granting of bail. Judges came inside the prison, granted some paroles and reductions, and the hostages were released. But when the prisoners continued to hold out, police stormed the jail with tear gas and clubs, and the revolt was over. Around the same time, in November 1970, in Folsom Prison in California, a work stoppage began which became the longest prison strike in the history of the United States. Most of the 2,400 prisoners held out in their cells for 19 days without food in the face of threats and intimidation. The strike was broken with a combination of force and deception, and four of the prisoners were sent on a 14-hour ride to another prison, shackled and naked on the floor of a van. One of the rebels wrote, "The spirit of awareness has grown. The seed has been planted."